listening to Regional Originals, a Masters of the Stage podcast. Regional Originals is a series of interviews with some of the most exciting directors and choreographers working in America's regional theater today.
Hi, I'm M. Graham Smith, and this is Masters of the Stage, Regional Originals, brought to you by the SDC Foundation. Our guest today is Lavina Jadwani. She's a Chicago-based director, adapter, and activist, and a second-generation immigrant. Lavina's directing credits include work at Actors Theater of Louisville, American Conservatory Theater, a solo repertory theater, Guthrie Theater, Mixed Blood Theater, Oregon Shakespeare Festival, where she was honored as a Killian Fellow, Remy Bumpo Theater Company, Teatro Vista Writers Theater, and Rasaka Theater Company, where she served as artistic director for 6 years. Lavina has continuing associations with Silk Road Rising, artistic associate, Steppenwolf Theater Company, artistic engagement associate, and the National New Play Network in the Affiliated Artists Council. Time Out Chicago named her their best next generation stage director in 2013. She is also my favorite person in the world to eat frozen yogurt with. Welcome, Lavina.
Why, thank you. You're also one of my favorite people to eat frozen yogurt with.
If you ever want to know where to eat frozen yogurt in any city in America, call me or Lavina. We know all the places. So the first question that I ask usually for these interviews is, where did you grow up and how did you find the theater, or how did the theater find you?
Sure. So I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. And, you know, I think both I found the theater and the theater found me, right? I think that I grew up being part of, you know, music and dance ensembles, and that's very rooted in South Asian culture in a way. You know, when you think about a big Indian wedding, oh, okay, well, there will be a sangeet where people will sing. There will be somebody who dances at the reception. And I think I just always really responded to the community feel of those events. I knew that I didn't, you know, necessarily want a big solo. I always felt very self-conscious on stage, but I liked being part of a group. And then I always think it's important for me to talk about the Illinois Mathematics and Science Academy, because I grew up in an education. I was very privileged to grow up in an education system that had a gifted program, and I think beginning in second grade, I just got used to being pulled out of traditional classes and being told, "Oh, okay, you know, you're special. You learn in a certain way, and we're gonna make space for that." So from second through eighth grade, that was a big part of my identity. And then I went to freshman year at sort of a more traditional high school experience, and you know, said, "Well, where's the gifted program?" And they said, "Oh, no, you're in honors classes." And I thought, "Oh, that's sort of not the same thing." And so this high school, the Illinois Mathematics and Science Academy, had been on my radar, and IMSA is for students who are in their sophomore through senior year. You can only come in your sophomore year, and they only do those 3 years because they sort of want people to have the opportunity to have a 1 year of the traditional high school experience, mm-hmm. whatever that may be. And, you know, also at the time, and I think this is still the case in some communities, particularly if you were a young woman in a gifted program, you were sort of naturally pushed towards math and science, right? STEM learning, as we now call it. And so I went to this high school mostly because we only had structured class 4 days a week, and one day was for research and independent study. And it was also sort of this defining moment for me because I think I grew up in a community that was very expressive, and lots of people had artistic passions and pursuits, but that was always the thing we kind of did on the side, right? Something else sort of defined us, or that was how we sort of chose to define ourselves. And I think when I went to this Math and Science Academy, that was the first time I went, oh, okay, I'm at a place where everybody is really smart. What kind of smart am I? And ended up doubling down on English and the humanities. And on those, it was Wednesdays, the days for research and independent study. You know, my pals who, you know, work for Google and Facebook and whatnot now, I mean, they mostly played video games. I studied Shakespeare and French literature. And so, yeah, I just, I felt like I didn't I was very privileged to grow up with a lot of the arts in my life, but actually going to a math and science academy was the thing that kind of forced me to identify as an artist. Yeah.
That's amazing. Is there like a production that you remember, or like a first experience with a production as a high school student?
Well, the first full-length play I ever directed at the Illinois Mathematics and Science Academy was, quite fittingly, Inherit the Wind.
Okay.
Which feels, I don't know, like a play I would still like to direct, actually. And that was a play that I had seen, I don't know, I think when I was a freshman in high school. But I think the idea of taking a play that examines an extremely divisive issue from multiple sides is something that I think is still important to my work, be that Row, be that a play like Viet Gone, a play like The Cake. That's, I think, something I'm super interested in when approaching new plays.
That's fantastic. When you work on new plays like Row or Viet Gone or Cake, I'm interested in how you approach that text, perhaps differently than a text like Inherit the Wind, which is kind of a classic of American theater repertory. You know, a lot of times in the American theater, I think we have this understanding that the playwright is queen or the playwright is king, and that kind of the way that they want things is going to be the way things go down in a production. And so I just wonder, do you have a different approach as a director working on a play like Three Sisters that you're working on now? Rather, is there a different way that you would do that rather than the way that you do Viet Gone or Cake?
You know, it's funny because I think when I approach a lot of these classics, I often sort of jokingly say in process, oh, I've never seen this play before, you know, or oh, let's pretend like we've never seen this play before. Yeah. I have no idea how it ends. And I'm realizing, as you're asking this really astute question, that a lot of times, especially when my relationship to new plays in the last couple of years has been that I'm doing, you know, second, third, fourth productions. So I have oftentimes the benefit of, okay, I know how somebody else has solved this, or I know that this is an option, this is something that I've seen work, this is something that I didn't think was particularly successful for all of those plays you just mentioned, as opposed to, I've actually never seen a production of Three Sisters before.
Uh-huh.
So in some ways...
That's so interesting.
Yeah, in some ways, it's kind of the reverse of what you'd expect, I guess.
Yeah. How do you deal with that when you're directing a play that you've already seen one or two productions of, and maybe even been involved with those productions? Do you find yourself going through any sort of process to make it fresh when you do it, or do you enjoy kind of having those options to fall back on if you aren't finding another one that pleases you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that's exciting about being able to see, let's just take Viet Gone, for example, since that's the most recent show I opened.
And you just opened that in Chicago at the Writers Theater?
Writers Theater, yeah, in Glencoe. And, you know, the first few times I experienced that play, I had no idea I was going to direct it. I just know what my experience was with it as an audience member. I got to experience the play before I ever read the play off the page. And so then for me, the challenge, the gift was I knew what it was like to experience the play as a first-time audience member, and I knew when I felt taken care of, and I knew when I didn't feel taken care of. And that's something that's very important in my work, be it an old play or a new one, is to advocate for the audience. I think that, you know, we can't tell everybody's story at once, as Bill Rausch often says, but I do think we can advocate for audience access and audience understanding. And so that's something I had to draw upon. I don't think I necessarily was concerned with, well, oh, this person did this choice, so I need to do something radically different, or, you know, maybe I'll just stick with the same thing. I think the thing that it did force me to do then was, or the trap, rather, of having experienced the play before having read it, was then there were a couple of times, especially because, you know, that play, you know, it's a new play, it changes.
Yeah.
Were there a couple of times where I was making assumptions about, oh, this story happens this way, and then would have to re-examine the text and say, wait, what does the text actually say?
Uh-huh.
Maybe that thing doesn't have to happen in the way that I first experienced, or, you know, the way that it is in my memory. Maybe there's something else.
That's great. When you did Row, at Oslo Theater in Florida, that script was continuing to evolve. Is that right? That you had seen that script evolve over almost a year of work.
Yeah, that play was, I always say that play was my grad school, because I think I spent almost as much time on that play as I did in grad school.
Oh my gosh.
I think we only changed one or two lines for Oslo, but
okay.
we opened that play in April of 2016.
Okay.
And ran it through October of 2016. We closed right before the election, which felt important because we had a certain understanding of the play, and I think certain assumptions about our nation that were quickly proven to be wrong. And so then we opened the play in D.C. We always knew we would open the play in D.C. 36 hours before the inauguration. We just didn't know which inauguration it would be or mm-hmm. how we would feel about it. And so the play suddenly felt much more urgent. And then bringing the play to Berkeley.
And should we say that, should we say that the play Roe is about the Roe v. Wade decision, in case our listeners
don't
know?
Yes. So Roe focuses primarily on Norma McCorvey, who was the real-life Jane Roe, and then Sarah Weddington, who is the lawyer who argued the case. Something we consistently hear about that show is people are surprised about how much of that history they didn't know.
Yeah.
That was certainly the case for me. And then I think the other big thing we hear about is people are surprised by how funny it is.
Yeah.
But I'm in this sort of unusual position, and this is about to change, because I know that there is at least one more regional production of that play slated later this season, and I hope many more to follow. But as of right now, there have only been four productions of that play, and I have worked on every single one of them, which is wild.
So what happens to you as a director, because the production that you were finally in the director's chair for was at the end of that mm-hmm. very long graduate school, as you called it, process, and you'd seen the play evolve over mm-hmm. that time. What do you do as a director with all that information of where you've seen the playwright wanting to go with the play as the play evolves and transforms?
Well, in some ways, again, it's wildly helpful, especially with the, you know, with any comedy. You know, it's math, right?
Mm-hmm.
Illinois Math and Science Academy. Thank you. You know, comedy is math, and so in some ways, it's really helpful to know some of the math and what works
yes.
and what doesn't.
Yes.
But at the same time, right? Not only is the world changing, you know, but doing that play in Sarasota was really different. Doing that play in March of 2018, you know, and there is language about gun control in that play that had a very different response in Sarasota in March of 2018
yeah.
than it did in, you know, Ashland or D.C. or Berkeley 2016, 2017. And how refreshing is that? We couldn't have anticipated that. We sort of knew that the conversation was changing, but, you know, how thrilling is that? I feel so privileged to have been a part of that play's journey and to know so much about how four very different communities responded to and engaged with that play.
That seems like a great opportunity to ask you a little bit about the way you perceive and understand the different regions that you work in, because you've worked in many different regions.
Uh-huh.
You're based in Chicago, which is a region unto itself. Can you help us characterize Chicago as a region, or Oregon as a region, or Florida as a region?
Yeah, I feel most qualified to answer the question about Chicago, and I think in terms of those other communities, I'm still learning.
Uh-huh.
You know, Chicago is a very, very strong, supportive community. I think it's a community that expects a lot. We expect a lot from each other, from our critics, from our audiences, and I sort of love that we are constantly raising the bar for ourselves and saying, hey, I think you can do better on that. I find that actually really exciting. And I guess I can speak to, you know, the more I travel, I get a lot of questions about, how we see you are encountering this issue in Chicago, and you know, you all are speaking or writing about it pretty publicly. Can I talk to you about that? Or, you know, we are starting to have this conversation as well. And that's something that I think is really exciting. I think The thing that I sort of really appreciate about my career right now also is like being able to take that, you know, Chicago integrity and work ethic and scrappiness, mm-hmm. I think will always be a part of my process. And then learning how other institutions, often much larger institutions, also approach similar problems. And I think it's exciting to me to, as a freelance director, to just be able to be a part of the culture of, you know, for me this season, 5 very different institutions,
yeah.
and be able to connect some dots, but also be able to identify some best practices, or be able to share some examples of, okay, I know that when I was at this other theater, and it was, you know, this time in this place, but this was the challenge we encountered. It seems like we are also encountering this challenge here at this different time and place, but maybe there are some things
yeah.
to be shared. Maybe I can connect these two institutions and you can have a conversation about it.
Can you tell us specifically about any one of these kind of we can do better conversations in Chicago, just to help us hang our hat on some of the details?
Yeah, I think the one that's most recently sort of on my radar, and actually because we have both seen Blacks at Steppenwolf,
yes.
and that has been talked about on
yes.
this podcast. So let's talk about that, because so I, as an audience engagement associate at Steppenwolf, do post-show discussions for many plays, including Blacks.
And this was the production directed by Nataki Garrett.
That's right.
That we talked about last season.
And
yeah.
and so Nataki is probably much better positioned to talk about this issue than I. But so as an audience engagement associate at Steppenwolf, which basically means I facilitate a lot of the post-show discussions,
yeah.
We were finding that play and a lot of our single ticket buyers were having a very different, much more vocal experience of the play in the audience than sort of some of Steppenwolf's traditional subscriber base.
Yeah.
And we encountered the same thing with Viet Gone at Writers. And so the question is, right, how do you create an environment where everybody feels comfortable experiencing that play as a community together, where nobody feels censored and everybody feels respected?
Yeah.
I don't have the silver bullet, by the way, right? Just to be
right.
clear, I don't have the answer to this question. But I know that, and we talked a little bit about this at Steppenwolf, you know, we encountered this question in previews, and we ended up... the artistic team, I believe, came up with a program insert.
Yes, which I keep with me in my wallet at all times now because it's the best.
So you want to pull it out? Should we read it? I don't know.
No, we've read it on the podcast once before.
Oh, okay.
So, but yeah, it is kind of a strategy to help people understand how to make space available and comfortable for all the people that might be in the room.
Yeah, and I think the thing that I... appreciate about that insert, apologies, I haven't finished that episode yet, I think.
Oh.
Right, is that feels like, it doesn't feel like a call out, it feels like a call in, it feels like an invitation.
Yes.
Here's how you can experience this. And I think that that's a conversation that I think, an introduction that I think many other theaters could perhaps benefit from and examine. So when we were encountering a similar thing at Writers with Viet Gone, you know, I shared that as an example and said, hey, maybe this is a way somebody has addressed this problem.
Yes.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about more. We're having a meeting next week to talk about it too when I'm back. So
that's amazing. It seems like this is actually something that is so much connected to your work with new plays. Is what are the things around the production? You know, sometimes I think in the theater we get into, you know, a kind of false understanding that the play is only the thing. The play is the thing that happens between 8 o'clock and 10 o'clock, and nothing else. You know, do we really need to concern ourselves with? But I think we're all understanding that that's not quite what the whole experience of taking in a new play really entails. What other kind of work are you doing? Building out from that singular experience of the production itself as you work on new plays?
Yeah, I think I came up with the idea, I was introduced, it's a better phrase, to the idea that, you know, the play is the appetizer, the post-show discussion is the meal. I think it was Jeffrey Jackson Scott
okay.
who said that to me early on in my career, and I've always loved that. I also will be very upfront about the fact that, you know, for a long time my bread and butter was... facilitating post-show discussions at institutions like Steppenwolf and Reiter. So, you know, that was my job. I got paid to do it. So, of course, I'm a little biased in that way. But I continue to engage with both those institutions and you know, I don't know, anybody else will ask, as a post-show discussion moderator. And I think that, for me, has been so formative to my work as a director because I have this gift of an opportunity to come in and host a discussion about somebody else's production of a play on a regular basis and get to see what conversations are prompted by the work. And then I think get to work backwards and think about, oh, okay, what are the moments, and especially if it's a new play where I've seen perhaps some other choices. You know, the big thing for Viet Gone was like, where do we maybe leave a little bit of the comedy on the table because that play is so funny, in favor of a more complex, nuanced choice that we can then have a conversation about afterwards.
That's great. I often think about what are the moments of the play that an audience member is going to have a conversation with somebody they know on the way home from the theater. And that's, you know, those are the things that excite me when I hear people or people get in touch with me and say, oh, we ended up talking about that moment.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about what your rehearsal room is like? Like, what would we expect to find? How do you like to take apart a play? Are you someone who likes to do a lot of table work? What's your rehearsal room?
You know, it really depends. I like to think that, well, regardless, I think the rehearsal room is, I think, both funny and focused. I grew up in a lot of just work hard, play hard cultures. I think that that's, you know, a part of my training at Carnegie Mellon. That's part of the Steppenwolf culture. And that's just something that has always been important to me. Oh, we get to work hard and we get to play hard. It's deeply important to me that I lead pretty horizontally. It's deeply important to me that everybody feels like they have a voice. If somebody says, hey, I want to try this thing, that, you know, for me, the answer is always yes. Let's try the thing and have a conversation about it rather than, you know, sort of have an intellectual discussion about, like, you know, the pluses and minuses beforehand. Let's try it and let's learn something.
Yeah.
Again, for everybody in the room, I love stage managers. My best friend from high school, also the Illinois Mathematics and Science Academy, is an equity stage manager. I have really learned, and I have had so many formative experiences as an assistant director. And so I love collaborating with stage managers and assistant directors. And the big thing that actually I learned from Bill Rausch, assisting him, which was a really successful collaboration for me, to think for him too, and certainly a very formative relationship. But what I learned from talking to other people in the cast, especially people who hadn't worked with Bill or with OSF before, was they said to me, oh, we learned how to collaborate with Bill by watching how he collaborated with you. And I thought, oh my gosh, of course. But like, I needed to hear that from somebody else to understand, you know, of course I love having assistance and love being able to provide, you know, mentorship and opportunities because I had so many of those and continue to have so many of those early in my career. But I, of course, that's also like a tool for
it's
me
a modeling
as a director
tool. Yes.
To model the way in which I like to collaborate.
That's amazing. What about auditions? What do you look for in actors for your production? I'm sure there are a lot of actors that are listening to this wondering how to get a role in a Lovina production.
I mean, my work is very, very text-based. So, you know, I want to know that you read the play and you made some choices based on the play. But I also want to know that you're going to come in and you're going to try some things. I think a lot of times, and this, I think, particularly with canonical work, right, we get into this place where we're worried about getting things right. And when we are worried about getting things right, we are not necessarily making the boldest, bravest, most successful artistic choices. You know, I think my favorite actors, my best friend, Gabe Ruiz, is an actor who often says he treats auditions like a first rehearsal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he works a lot. but I sort of love it when actors come in and treat it like a first rehearsal, right? They, you know, and audition me as much as I'm auditioning you, right? I think that, you know, Gabe talks about, and I've talked about, you know, there's some auditions that really clearly go really well, and we're all really excited to engage with each other. And there's some auditions where you just go like, wow, we don't speak the same language. Mm-hmm. Like, we're both really good at our jobs, we don't speak the same language, or we're not interested in the same version of this play. Oh my gosh, we just saved ourselves like 5 or 6 weeks of a miserable process.
Yes.
Great.
Yes. I just was teaching an audition intensive last night here in San Francisco, and we talked about this very thing that I think a lot of times actors believe that they're in the position of, you know, they're interviewing me for this job.
Yeah.
And we were trying to find ways to think about how the actor can also and needs to also be interviewing the director to see if this is a match for someone I can collaborate with for the next 6 weeks. Can you say anything about anything more about that kind of matchmaking process that's happening?
Well, I guess I will say this, and I think you asked me right before we started if there was anything that like was deeply important for me to depart.
Yeah,
and I was like,
yeah.
No. And I was like, wait, no. This is the thing that I'm constantly asking myself, and this is the thing that I am trying to impart these days, is for me, you know, being an artist and being an activist, those two things are synonymous for me. It's only recently that I started putting that in my bios because I realized, oh, not everybody does see those things
yep.
as synonymous. So, okay, I should state them. But I think, you know, if I'm a director pitching a play, if I'm an actor coming into a room and I've got 90 seconds, yes, I'm there, of course, to advocate for myself. I want to direct for your theater. I want to be in your play. But also, who else are you willing to go to the mat for, right? If I pitch a play, I'm saying I value this story. If you speak 90 seconds of text, that's a choice, right? You're telling me I can say anybody's words. Okay, maybe there's some parameters about genre or whatever, mm-hmm. right? But even within that, I can say anybody's words. So this is who I want to go to the mat for. Like, those are the choices that get me really excited. And I think that that's something, I know you often ask for advice in these. I listen. You know, and I agree with it. I think Kwame said, right, advice is hard because, you know, it so depends on,
yes.
on the person. But I think
it's hard to do one size fits all anything.
But I think things that I wish I had said to, you know, 20-something Lavina, because I, during graduate school or even outside of school, had friends, had colleagues. You know, I write a lot of things on HowlRound, on Rescripted, whatever. I write, I'm pretty forthright in expressing my opinions about our field, about inclusion, about where and what I think we could be doing better. And I had a lot of people say, are you sure you want to say that thing so specifically, so publicly? Some people are not going to want to work with you if you say that. And I think at first I sort of was silenced by that pushback, and then I realized.
Can you say more about what kind of thing you're talking about? Is there a specific example?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think let's use a piece on, I've written on HowlRound, right? I wrote a piece about the case for hiring Asian American directors.
Yes.
You know, it's. I think that, and we are seeing more and more contemporary Asian American playwrights advocate for.
Yes.
Also an act for advocacy. Yes, I want you to produce my play, but also I would like for you to hire an Asian American director to do it. And listen, I don't necessarily think that director-playwright pairing should be matchy-matchy, but I do think that there is a cultural fluency, a cultural competency that an Asian American director can bring to the table that
yes.
a director outside the community cannot. And I wrote that piece because I was having a lot of hurt feelings about, you know, not seeing that happen specifically within Chicago, and have, you know, specified other theater companies where I think, hey, I think you can do better about that. Like, right, we've talked about that, and I guess my thought is though, right, if somebody's going to be turned off or not want to engage with me because of my saying that kind of thing, again, great, we just saved ourselves a miserable collaboration process, right?
Right?
There are, I mean, especially in, listen, I know that I'm privileged in that I come from Chicago. It is a very saturated theater market. I cannot work for all the theaters in Chicago.
Yeah.
But also, I don't want to.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, why not find that out sooner rather than later? We're not working on the same things. Awesome. You go work on your thing, I'll go work on mine. I'll come see your work.
Yes.
But if we're not working on the same things, why would I want to force that? And why would I censor who I am so that I couldn't potentially work there if it's
yes.
not if we're not working on the same things?
Yes. So if I could extrapolate from all of that information, I'm an actor who comes into your audition room and I do an audition and you say, great, do you have any questions? And I say, I do have a question. I would like to know how you're handling X moment in the play, because that's a moment that means a lot to me, maybe as a gay actor. Let's say I say that to you. How are you going to handle this moment in Laramie Project, let's say? Would that be something that you really appreciate? Or would that
Yes. Oh my gosh. I mean, especially, you know, with me and my straight privilege, tell me why you're passionate about that moment. Tell me the things I can't see. Oh my gosh, of course. I will say, listen, here are the things I know and here are the things I don't know, but I would be so excited to hear that question and to know that that's right. That's a moment that you're interested in advocating for. Why would I not want that?
Right. That's great. What about designers? How do you use designers in your process of kind of unmasking a play or getting to know a play?
Well, you know, I was trained as a designer, right?
I didn't know that.
Oh, you didn't?
No.
Really? Yeah, okay, that's probably because, so I have a BFA in scenic design from Carnegie Mellon, but when as I was finishing that program, I realized, and sort of the faculty told me, and it was very painful at first because I felt very rejected by this assessment. But they're like, "No, we think you're an actor. We think you're a director." And so I did a BFA in scenic design, and then I also did an arts management degree at Carnegie. And when I graduated, I just said I had a BFA from Carnegie Mellon and that I wanted to direct plays. I didn't say what it was. Now I do. Now it's an interesting part of the story, and because I also have an MFA in directing. But I love designers. My favorite designers are also brilliant dramaturgs. You know, I consider myself a 360-degree storyteller. I like being able to speak in terms of story. That's always how my process starts. And any time that there is, I don't know, conflict in process, be that with anybody, for me it's about speaking in terms of story, and it's about, you know, that I think it's Katie Mitchell advice, or at least that's where I got it from, right? Of letting the text be the arbiter of any debate. This is what the text proposes, so we have to make sure we are honoring that. This is the broader story we're trying to tell.
Yes.
I think those two things get priority. I think.
Yes.
Ego does not.
I'm always just curious about how a director starts their first conversation with a designer. Do you ask for research? Do you give a designer things that are like, these are the things that the design must have because of what the text tells us? So you have to solve these three needs first. How do you start that conversation?
Again, for me, it's about story, and I think particularly, you know, when I'm working on canonical work, let's say As You Like It, it's on my brain right now. You know, my conversations with designers for that production, which is still very much in process, starts with me saying, okay, I read this play right now, and here's what I see. I see a broken world that becomes a little more whole by the end of it. I see a play with a lot of healing in it. I see a play with two very different communities that feel very far apart from each other but get a little closer by the end of the play. And also I see a play with a lot of toxic masculinity at the top that then also has this like healing maternal goddess presence at the end. Those are the big things that I'm excited by and interested in that are based in the text but also based in, you know, who I am and where we are right now. And then let's start the conversation from there. I know I was talking with a set designer about this yesterday. I know I'm not the first person to say this, but, you know, especially say when we're working on Shakespeare, we're juggling three or four time periods at any given time,
yeah,
right? If I'm working on Julius Caesar, which is another play on my brain right now, I'm dealing with the time period in which Shakespeare wrote. I'm dealing with the time period that Shakespeare was writing about. I'm dealing with whatever the world of the production is. And then I'm dealing with the here and the now, right?
Yes.
That which is where my audience is. So how do I make those three or four worlds talk to each other, in line with each other? How do I make that sing?
Yeah.
It doesn't mean, and it can mean that, you know, that sometimes those things are in contradiction, but that I haven't ignored that. I've embraced those choices.
That's great. That's really super helpful. So I always love to ask this question, mostly because it leads to a story that is pretty fun to listen to is, can you tell us about a catastrophe that has befallen a production of yours or that's befallen a part of your process that you learned something from?
Oh, totally. how much time do we have? So I'm a former artistic director. I was the artistic director of Roscoe Theatre Company for 6 or 7 years. We are the Midwest's first South Asian American ensemble, Chicago-based theater company. And one of the first things I did as artistic director there was we got this grant to get 10 South Asian writers, and you had to either come from a theater background and or some kind of writing background, and we got a grant to do a weekend boot camp with a playwriting instructor from Chicago Dramatists. And so we had a really successful playwriting boot camp. And then we got another grant to develop these 10 plays. So the weekend boot camp was very focused on the writer's experience and emerging writers. But then when we got to the workshop experience, I also wanted to give directors within our community opportunity. I also wanted to give actors within our community an opportunity. And the big thing that I learned the hard way, and because I don't know, this term emerging early career, whatever, what does it mean? But I set some people up for failure, I think, or not. I did not set them up for success by having both an emerging playwright, an emerging director, and emerging actors all in one room.
Uh-huh.
Was confusing and not helpful to everybody. And so that's something that I have, that was a lesson that I learned the hard way of, okay, you have to be really specific about what you're working on and who and what you're looking to develop, and then build the room around that. You can't develop everything at once. It's too many moving pieces.
Yeah.
And so that's something, again, my buddy Gabe sort of pointed out to me recently in our process on Viet Gone. He worked with me as a composer and music director on this one, which was a first for him.
Uh-huh.
He identifies primarily as an actor, that there were a couple places, you could see it, there were like a couple places on the acting end, a couple places on the design and production end, where you're like, okay, these are the places where I know I'm doing a little more work,
uh-huh.
But then here are the places where I know these are my anchors.
Yes.
And what a great opportunity to then have, you know, people who are maybe, again, newer to working at that level, be able to learn from folks who are more experienced, but also for folks who are more experienced to get questions or pushback from people who are newer to say, oh, actually, maybe we don't need to do that thing that way.
Right. Why are we always doing
that? Why are we always doing that thing? Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like, I mean, I don't know how many designers you're allowed to bring along with you on the productions that you do, but I always feel like that's such a tricky thing when you're directing maybe for the first time with a company, is like, is everyone I'm working with going to be new, and it's going to be starting from zero, and I don't have anyone that I have this quicker language with that comes from experience. How do you handle that when you are, you know, working for the first time? You're working for the first time at the Guthrie.
Yeah.
Coming up, directing As You Like It. How many designers are you bringing, and how are you managing that new relationship with a company?
There's only one designer I've worked with before.
Okay.
Sarah Huey, who's a brilliant line designer. And she and I we're having a season together. She did Viet Gone at Writers. We're doing As You Like It together. We're doing The Cake at Oslo. So Sarah's like my anchor this season.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Lauren Keating, my brilliant producer, and I were very clear on the fact that, like, yes, I would like to have somebody, at least one person that I've worked with before. That's very important to me in terms of my collaborative language. I have, like, one person who knows what my shorthand is, who can also sort of help who is also a designer, who can help me identify, hey, you need to spell that thing out, because I
yeah.
know what you mean, nobody else does. But also it was deeply important just to have people who know that space really well. Listen,
yeah.
that is a huge demanding thrust, and so we really wanted to prioritize for on scenery and costumes in particular, somebody who knew that space and knew the institution well.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm
that new emerging risk for them. I'm very aware
right,
of that,
right?
I'm the first time director and I'm driving the big bus. So yeah, of course we should support me with people who know, you know, not only the space, but the shops and that community very well, because that's something else that's always very important to me is, you know, to be a good citizen of the theater, to be a good citizen of the institution, to know that when I ask for something, Of course, we'd never really know, right? Like, oh, yeah, I'm asking for that thing. Mm-hmm. What does that dollar amount actually mean? What does that amount of labor actually mean? But, you know, to have a sense of what that is really important to me. And it's really helpful to have some designers who are returning to the institution who can help sort of clue me in on how to ask for things, what to expect from production, from shops, et cetera.
That's so wonderful. It's so important, I think, to set yourself up for success in that way. And I'm glad to hear that. Sounds like things are heading towards success for that production.
Sure.
So we only have a few minutes left, and I wanted to see if I could ask you a question to, you know, solve all the problems in the American theater in one question.
Sure.
As somebody who works in the regional theater system of this country, I feel like there is a very kind of systematized way in which we do productions in this country. We start design like 9 months out. We start rehearsals, 4 weeks maybe if we're lucky from opening night, and I just wonder. There are so many other ways. There are so many ways that other countries develop new plays and bring new plays along to production. I wonder if there were one wish that you had for the system to work differently, if you could do one ask, whether that would be, oh, the set would all be finished by the first day of rehearsal, or we would get to rehearse for 6 weeks instead of 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. Is there one wish that you think could really help the way that you like to work as a director?
I guess my wish would be, you know, in the same way that I approach the text and say, okay, well, what is the story and what does this play demand? And I totally understand why this is an impossible ask, but I'm asking it anyway. You know, I wish that we could get better at tailoring our rehearsal process to meet the needs of the specific project, the specific production team, as well as the needs of the institution. You know, I was listening to the interview you had with Dominique Williams, right, and talking about decolonizing her practice, right, which is something I'm also very interested in, and that you know, time is the colonizer in the room, right? We have
yes.
to take a break every 80 minutes. But also, how can we create the flexibility in our process, be it the rehearsal process, be it the tech process, previews, whatever. I do think that, and again, I understand why this has to happen, that we fall into patterns. For example, when we were teching Viet Gone, I was given a template of, well, here's the tech schedule that we typically have for, you know, a new play, and then here's the tech schedule we typically have for a musical. And I was like, well, my play is both of those things.
Right.
Right? So, why is it a binary?
Right.
Again, totally understanding what the challenges are on the production end, right?
Yeah.
But how can we? It feels like we know what the model is for the season,
mm-hmm.
and then we program the plays, and then we fit the plays in the slots.
Yeah.
But sometimes that game of Tetris is brilliant, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes we don't get to see the seasons we want to see because the Tetris doesn't quite work. So I guess I just wonder how can we think less linearly and more, I don't know, circularly, creatively about that.
To address the particular needs of each production as they come. I wonder about that a lot. I just dream of moving to Russia where, you know, I've heard that you could rehearse a play for a year and be like, okay, we're almost ready for previews.
Yeah. And again, that's something that I think, you know, me with my scrappy storefront Chicago roots is I'm used to being able to do sort of a little more nimbly.
Yes.
When I'm working at the storefront level, but I had an advisor in grad school, right, who was a former artistic director and took the theater's annual operating budget and then divided by 365 days and was like, great, I now run a dragon that needs to be fed this much money every day,
which
is sort of terrifying math.
Yes.
You know, but when we know that we are working with a, you know, much larger, much more expensive dragon, how can we still sort of remain
nimble?
Nimble. And nimble and flexible, and again, right, that conversation starting from a place of how can we best support, what is the story, how can we best support it?
Yeah. Well, Lavina, it's been so great to sit down and chat with you and solve all of American theater's problems in one conversation.
Great.
You're welcome, American theater. Can you tell us about, you briefly mentioned some of the things coming up, and I just want to let people know when those things are happening, so if they happen to be in those places, they can see your work. You've got As You Like It coming up at the Guthrie in January, February?
I rehearse January, February. We run February, March.
Great.
I've got another production before that, also in Minneapolis. I'm doing Brendan Jacob Jenkins' Gloria, Mixed Blood, in November, December, and that's running in rep with Hype Man and Hooded.
Awesome.
Three other awesome plays, two other awesome
that
plays.
That sounds like an awesome rep festival.
It is an awesome, and I love working in rep. Mixed Blood is not a theater that traditionally operates in rep, and they have done rep in the past, but not in the way that certainly an institution like OSF or Oslo does. And I have to say that is an experience that I had not previously had working in Chicago, and I love it so much because I think it just allows room for us to sort of learn from each other. Obviously, it's there are certain demands. It's very stressful. It does not often allow people to be nimble in the way that we're just talking about, right? Because, you have to tech on these 2 days so that somebody else can tech on these 2 days. And,
yes.
But I have often found, particularly at Oslo, the stage manager for my show and the ASM, they sort of might swap on the on another show in the season, right? The ASM becomes the SM and vice versa.
Oh,
and it just keeps everybody, honest and humble and working together and learning from each other. And I love that. And then, speaking of working in rep, you can see the cake at Oslo Rep in...
By Becca Brunstetter.
Becca Brunstetter
April, May.
Of 2019.
There's a gay cake coming to Florida.
I just want to see a play with cake in the lobby afterwards.
Yes.
Spoilers, there's cake in the lobby afterwards. It's written into the play. I love that.
Let's go get some froyo.
Okay.
And
some cake.
Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh my gosh, yeah, thanks for having me.
This podcast was brought to you by SDC Foundation. SDC Foundation events and programs are designed to offer access, opportunity, and community to directors and choreographers at all levels of their career. To find out more, you can go to our website at www.sdcfoundation.org.